Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Good evening, everyone. This is Terry Hutchinson with John Gee and Kevin Christensen in for the Interpreter Foundation this evening for the second hour of our broadcast tonight. And we are going to be doing a Come Follow Me for the lesson
Acts
that we're covering. Acts 22 through 28, which is, I believe, July 29th through August the 4th. So that week. And it covers the journeys of Paul. Kevin, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. So this segment is basically Paul spends a good portion of the time in prison. In a holding cell, a holding pattern, if you will, because he claims his Roman citizenship, and that causes some problems for those who are attacking him. And eventually, he appeals his way all the way up to Caesar, and that's how he winds up in Rome.
Yes, and it's one of the rights he has as a Roman citizen to appeal to Caesar, appeal to the head of the government. You have to realize most of the subjects in the Roman Empire weren't citizens. They were subjects, and they have a much lower... The vast majority are second and third class citizens, and he's actually a first class citizen.
Yeah.
So he has a right not to be beaten without being convicted, where otherwise you could get beaten if needed, if they thought it was needed. And so he exercises these citizenships. One of the things we don't catch here so much is that Luke is with him. And
yeah.
So you get those we passages in Acts.
I noticed that change in the tense. Yeah.
And before, you know, it's not out of the third person into the first person plural. He's there. And this is where Luke does his research. While Paul is sitting in prison for 3 years, Luke is free to go. And he's wandering around and getting firsthand stories from Jesus' family. So you've got James, the brother of Jesus, mm-hmm. Mary appears to still be around. And so he's getting all of these eyewitness stories that he uses to compile his gospel and then the book of Acts. And so we kind of, because the focus is on Paul, we missed necessarily that Luke's chance to be the historian and to provide his witness.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting to talk about Luke as a historian for a minute because, you know, in the previous hour we talked about how certain elements of Roman economics could be used to give you further insight into some of the parables. And as I was going through this, Richard Bauckham has written a book called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, which is foundational for a lot of people about the historical Jesus and verifying the Gospels themselves as, you know, the stories of people who actually were witnesses. And when you say Luke was doing the background and interviewing the people for writing the gospel, he also, in the book of Acts, does something that's very common for Greco-Roman historians, if I pronounce that correctly.
Yeah, you did.
And that is, he gives the cities, the rivers, the hills. When he talks about the shipwreck, he identifies the island or the location where they were. And that was standard practice for historians of that time. It's another evidence that, and it's pretty, it's commonly accepted, it appears in the scholarship, that Acts is a legitimate history of that period written by somebody trained up to write histories. Now, the history may not be 100% accurate and correct like we expect it to be here in the 21st century, but close enough. And the fact that it adds these kind of details is an element that gives us some additional background or additional feel for what the apostles were going through at that time. But then it also struck me that that's exactly the same kind of detail we get from those who write in the Book of Mormon.
Yes.
Now, I'm not a big proponent of Book of Mormon geography per se. I've made that very plain.
Yeah.
Here at Interpreter, we spent... I don't know, they put a lot into recently a criticism of a certain type of geographical theory, which...
Actually, that was an interpreter. They just linked to somebody else.
Oh, they linked to the blog. That's what they did.
Right.
I just it came up on my interpreter feed.
Right.
Just,
but you know, geography has important aspects. I'm working on a bit of Mesopotamian geography for one of the projects I'm working on and trying to see what you can say about the location of a particular hotly disputed Mesopotamian or in the area of Mesopotamia city. And there have been all kinds of proposals. So this sort of dispute in Book of Mormon isn't unusual, that people wouldn't necessarily agree. But you have to go back to what evidence are you basing on, what lines of reasoning. Mm-hmm. But the fact that they're keyed into that geography.
Yes.
Because that's just a matter of fact. And mm-hmm. we do it all the time, too. We just don't realize that we're doing it. Anytime, you know, you might, you know, a father might say, be asked by his wife, go pick up the kids at the school. And that's something very different in the family because everybody knows where all that is. But if you got, say, an uncle in town, an uncle and aunt, and you ask them to pick up the kids, suddenly this becomes a very difficult
proposition. You have to give them more detailed directions.
And the way that they use this geographic information back then is people say, yes, I know where that is, or I know about that place. Mm-hmm. And so it just feeds in. We don't have to tell people about where New York is located.
Well,
we can use that as a reference point, New York City.
Yeah.
For the most part, you don't have to mention that. Everybody knows or everybody can find out.
Mm-hmm.
But they often didn't. And so for us, that makes it a strange world. But it shows that they're dealing with real places.
Right. And, you know, Bauckham has collected a lot of articles about the New Testament and its historicity and in particular Acts and so forth. There was another one that I was looking at where he talked about Paul's going to the west instead of the east. And one of the things that is mentioned early in Acts and then kind of disappears because it focuses mostly on Paul's journeys is that Jerusalem was at the center of the world at that time. Rome wasn't the center of the world. Rome was the power, but Jerusalem was at the center of the Jewish world, if you will. And so just as the Jews in the West, there were Jews in the West, there were even more in the East. And the connections between Jerusalem and the Babylonians and the Persians and everybody to the East was far greater. There were far more Jews and that it's interesting that Paul never really made it over there to preach like maybe he planned to. And he says there were circumstances that kept him from doing it. One of them was being imprisoned here and eventually having to go west instead of east. But he suspects that Paul's original intention was to go to the east.
Well, and some people did. Some of the apostles, or at least traditionally, went over there.
Yeah.
And you're right about the shift. You think about it. The Talmud that
comes from Babylon.
The Babylonian Talmud. It's from Babylon, which was outside of the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul is very much a Roman Empire person, and being a citizen feeds into that and gives him certain privileges. For example, as a citizen, he has a right to a ration, a stipend on at least a monthly basis for food. And apparently he works as a tent maker so that he doesn't have to take that, to set an example for all the subjects
who don't have
Roman subjects who don't have that. And he doesn't, and they're contributing all these taxes so that the Roman citizens can have free bread. And so there is a little bit of an economic mm-hmm. end on that, but Paul is very much uses his Roman citizenship to get around the Roman Empire, which is still
it's a big undertaking,
big place, mm-hmm. and He had had plans to get to Spain, or had hoped to. Doesn't seem to have made it. We don't really know, but that's his lot falls to the West, whereas other people's lots fall.
Well, Thomas traditionally went to India.
And there are Indian Christians who claimed that. And Paul doesn't make it to Egypt or Alexandria. Mark is supposed to have made it to Alexandria and started a church there. And so you have this spread of it, but partly because Luke is writing this and he's writing what he knows best. So he spends six chapters leading up to Paul, and then the next 22 is
all about Paul
because that's who he
is. But that's his companion, yeah.
That's where he's got first-hand information. And either because he's seen it himself or because Paul can tell him about it. And it's nice that you got the Gospel of Luke to show that he'd had interest in pulling that material. And if you look at the Greek of the various Gospel writers, it's all fairly basic as far as it goes, but Luke has the best Greek. But we're getting a little sidetracked. We want to talk a little bit about sharing testimony. I'm not sure how much time
we have. We've got a couple minutes to the break, and then we can hit it in after the break.
But one of the things about Paul is that he shares his testimony quite a bit. He's always preaching. He'll go to a new place. He has a pattern of goes to the Jewish synagogues
and
preaches there. And then if that doesn't work, then he goes out to other places. But he's always trying to connect to his audience. In Acts 17, he'll quote pagan poets. Aretas' Phenomenon is a poem in Greek about astronomy, and Paul quotes it to the Athenians to make a point. He's well-read in this literature, and he is trying to get people to embrace the gospel.
And he was absolutely fearless about preaching. I thought it was interesting that when he was arguing with, or basically he was imprisoned in his argument to Agrippa, among others, he's basically getting into a philosophical disagreement with his accusers. And ultimately, Agrippa and the others say, this is something about their religious beliefs. This has nothing to do with a crime or anything else. And then he says, in fact, I'd set him free, except for he's got this pending appeal to Caesar, so now we have to ship him off to Rome. Because, you know, he took it a little bit too far. That's another place where some of these background things come into play to explain why he's doing what he's doing. But ultimately, the most important part of this story is that he is witnessing and continually witnessing.
And he's willing to bring in all the eloquence and all the arguments he muster. If you read Paul in Greek, it's a lot like reading Elder Maxwell in English. He has all of this. These plays on words that are in some cases impossible to translate or difficult. You can translate the meaning, but everything that he's doing rhetorically just disappears when you pull it through translation. But he's using everything at his disposal. So if he's in Galatians, he's arguing against the Judaizers using Jewish logic, which we don't really use. And so some of his logic just saying, what on earth is he talking about? But he's out-Judaizing the Judaizers, using their logic to show that they're, using Jewish logic to show that you shouldn't Judaize. Paul can get away with that because he's got that sort of background, but he's willing to apply it. And he's also willing to take on Roman practices. Some of the things that he mentions as sins weren't things that Jesus talked about. but were prevalent in the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. Homosexuality is one of those. And as one of my early Christianity professors famously put it, I'm afraid that Paul was somewhat homophobic. That was what his expression of that. Well, he recognized that it was wrong, and that was a big problem in the Roman Empire, and he was willing to say that it was wrong. That's how bold he was. He was willing to critique those practices that can't have made him popular.
That's right. Okay, we'll be back with some more of our Come Follow Me discussion with Kevin Christensen and John Gee right after the break. Please stay tuned. Kevin, you'll be up next. Good evening, everyone. Terry Hutchinson with John Gee and Kevin Christensen here for Interpreter Radio, sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation. And just a quick note that Interpreter Foundation is an all-volunteer effort, but we do request donations. They are tax-deductible. And the primary use of the funds is to basically put out the articles that they release every week and also to do an upcoming film on the three witnesses.
And things like pay for the website.
That's right. Just the basics.
Which
to keep things going.
Yeah.
That's right. So, Kevin, in your reading of this section of, about Paul, what stood out to you as being the most important?
Well, I'm just thinking about his personality and his absolute conviction and his fearlessness. And there's something that really strikes me about it is that he's not just trying to put on a good impression, but he's telling people what he'd done and making that an important part of his story. You know, he's when he talks about his conversions, you know, that he's traveling doing this business of doing persecuting. And then he says, and it came to pass that I made my journey and was come nigh unto Damascus about noon. Suddenly there shone from heaven a great light around me. And I fell into the ground and heard a voice saying unto me, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? And I answered, Who art thou, Lord? And he said unto me, I am Jesus of Nazareth. And one of Margaret Barker's books just has, for the start of it, just has that, Who art thou, Lord? And he said unto me, I am Jesus. Now, if he'd said that in Hebrew, that would have been an interesting theological statement that we could get off on for a while. But it's just, and he just talks about, you know, having to react to that and put it together. There's not a lot of introspection in those next moments, but it's, the character comes out through his actions, but he just gets down to business and he goes and he changes and when he's telling this story, it's like he has to mention that he's done bad things. You know, that he says, and when the blood of thy martyr Stephen was shed, I also was standing by and consenting to his death and kept the raiment of them that slew him. So he hasn't got clean hands and a pure heart, you know, behind him, but he's certainly showing. And his absolute conviction, and just reading it, it's very moving and touching. You know, along with all of the shipwrecks and the politics and the dramatic stories of escapes and prison and captures and all of this. There's this sense of a very strong personality who's had a transformative experience and wants to share it, and is willing to go to whatever lengths. There's this. A sense of I will do whatever it takes kind of commitment, where he's not counting the cost. He's all focused on the job.
Well, for me, his talking about his past, if you will, is also trying to get credibility because, as John had mentioned, he typically starts at the synagogues and then he branches out from there. So, to me, he's also saying he's being humble in admitting his wrongdoing, but he's also saying, hey, I'm one of you. I learned the law from Gamaliel, who's, everybody knows who he is at that time.
Yeah.
And so he's using that to establish, I'm one of you, but now because of this experience, I'm over here and I'm doing this. So it's in addition to, yes, I've done bad things and now I'm saved. It's also, I was one of you and now we move over there. And it's another way he reaches out to do his witness to try and gain credibility with his listeners, which I think is important when we're witnessing to people.
Yeah, that's true. That's a very good point. then we get a little bit more of his personality in the next chapter right at the start when he's my brother and I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day. And the high priest Ananias commanded them that stood by him to smite him on the mouth. And then Paul said unto him, God shall smite thee that whited wall. First sittest thou to judge me after the law, and commandest me to be smitten contrary to the law. And so he also got a temper on him. No, he's not going to put up with anything. He doesn't have to. But then they say, oh, this was the high priest. And then Paul says, okay, I didn't know he was the high priest. Thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people. But then he shows, you know, the sense of, he starts talking about being a Pharisee, the son of the Pharisee, and of the hope of the resurrection of the dead. I'm called into question. So he brings this debate into it. And
he's going to try and get them to fight amongst themselves rather than to aim at him.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, he talked about he's got the credibility, and he's also got the cred. He understands what's going on with these groups that he's talking to. And he uses his knowledge in really interesting ways, to help, because he'd had the revelation where, Jesus told him, I'm going to send you to Rome, I'm going to send you out to testify. And he fully embraces that. And I think even when he's doing this kind of thing, he's got that sense of mission. And he's using, as John said, he's using everything that he's got. All of his talents. It's a total commitment of everything that he has that he's pouring into this new commitment that he has. And it shows up in all of these adventures and dialogues. There's always that sense of that he has to do this, and he will do whatever it takes to do what God has asked him to do. And he's not counting the price. He's just urgently doing whatever it takes to get through to do what God has asked him to do. It's very impressive.
So, John, you've brought your handy Greek version of the Old New Testament here.
I brought that here. One of the things that brings up in the lesson, when we're talking about Paul's background and his tailoring the message to, this is an example of it. So if you look, Paul tells this story about his conversion on the road to Damascus three times in the book of Acts.
Yeah.
They're a little bit different each time.
Yeah, kind of like the first vision differences.
Right, but this one is interesting. So there's a detail, and it shows up in Acts 26:14. And this is the only time it actually shows up. There's some manuscripts that try to harmonize the accounts, and one of those gets into the King James. But he has this little line about it is hard, he says, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? And he says, well, who are you? But it also says, it is hard for you to kick against the pricks. Well, that one shows up in 26. I can't remember which manuscripts the King James is following, but the good manuscripts only have it in 26. He doesn't say that when he's talking to the Jews on the wall. It doesn't really show up in the first time. It shows up when he's talking to Agrippa and Felix, who would appreciate this detail.
Mm-hmm.
Now, kicking against the pricks, so it's to the kentra, which is a translated as a prick, is a goad. It's a sharpened stick that you poke the cow with to get the cow to move. Well, the cow can kick against that, but if it kicks, it's just going to injure them. Kendra is also the word used for a stinger on a bee or a wasp. And this only hurts yourself if you try to kick, and you, the more force you put in it, the more the stick drives itself into you. So it really doesn't help you. Well, it works on that level. But this is also a quote from literature, from specifically Greek literature, which is why Agrippa and Festus would pick it up and would not be appreciated at all by the crowd on the wall. And it's like quoting a movie line. And apparently Jesus does this. It hits Paul like a ton of brick. It comes from Euripides' play, The Bacchae. And in that play, you have the god Dionysus going down to Thebes the ruler is Pentheus, and Pentheus doesn't like the Bacchic rites, thinks that Dionysus claims to be the son of Zeus, and so he's the son of God, he's divine, and he's got this religion, and Pentheus goes about persecuting it, and in the end is ripped to shreds by his own mother and aunts in a Bacchic frenzy. But but he's going around persecuting the worshippers and Dionysus in particular. And just before the crucial twist there, then Dionysus says this to Pentheus. It says, it's going to be hard for you to kick against the pricks, and uses this phrase. And so that when Jesus cites it to Paul, he recognizes where this is from, and Festus and Agrippa will as well. And so the idea that he'd been persecuting somebody who's claimed to be the Son of God, but unlike Pentheus, Saul repents.
Mm-hmm.
And so he uses this line there, and it's not in the other places, and with very particular to people who would appreciate it, but his use of that particular line just before that key thing where Pentheus goes mad is, of that line, brings that whole force of the play, even though it's a pagan play, into Paul's consciousness and into the consciousness.
But that's the line that Jesus gave him directly.
Right. And it's a line that, well, Jesus knows how to communicate.
Oh, yeah.
And he picks out this line that would have all of that import to Paul, and Paul would recognize where it comes
Paul
from.
Paul selectively uses it later in relating the story.
Right, and later and chooses when to use it. But Jesus knows Paul's background and can mm-hmm. pick something to communicate the precarious position that Paul found himself in. And so it's interesting that he only drops this detail to the people who would appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about differences in the story, this is one particular one out of Paul's background that comes as a surprise and to his ancient audiences would have really been telling.
Mm-hmm. So, Kevin, what are some of the other unique phases of the witnessing that you see from Paul?
Well, I like the way that just when he's reasoning, you know, first with Festus and Agrippa, the way that he just really wants them to know that to him this is utterly real. You know, I am not mad, most noble Festus, but speaketh with words of truth and soberness. And you know, getting this gets up to the famous line with Agrippa, where Agrippa said unto Paul, almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian. And Paul said, I would to God that not only thou, but also all that hear me this day were both almost and altogether as I am, except these bonds. That's just really beautiful. You know, and it's one of the things that I get, you know, in reading these discussions that he has with people in the back and forth, you know, those who reject him and those that accept him. One of the things I started paying attention to some years ago was just the logic that's used on both sides. You know, what are what do the people that see God in, you know, Paul as a prophet, what do they look at that they see, and what are the people on the other side looking? And that sort of thing is one of the things that, you know, convinced me that all of this was real, because I compared it to the, you know, the modern day discussions, and we do the same stuff. We, you know, the people that reject Paul use the same kind of rhetoric and the same, you know, distractions and disconnects that are used to reject Joseph Smith. And it's also interesting, too, you know, the lesson asks us to think about, you know, Joseph Smith in this, because Paul says, you know, he thought of himself that way. You know, in the accounts of the first vision, he says, he compares himself to Paul. So he's, you know, he sees himself in Paul and Paul in himself. And I, as I do that, it helps me appreciate Joseph Smith himself, because, you know, I'd seen a vision and I knew it, and who am I to withstand God? And this is Paul's thing. This is where his fearlessness comes from. This, you know, he's He's got that total commitment to this experience that he's had, and he can't do other than what he does with full heart.
Very similar to Alma the Younger.
Yes. At least with Paul, you know that he was doing everything wholeheartedly even before.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he's all in.
And does a complete about face. I think one of the impressive things about the story when it's first told is Ananias takes a lot of persuading to even talk with Paul. Do you know who this is? And Jesus' response is sort of, yes, I know, you don't know who this is. And I think he serves as a model for us. When Paul says he's not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, from Luke's account of him, he definitely isn't, and he's willing to put himself on the line in lots of places where a lot of us, I think, would have some second thoughts about.
It's interesting when he goes to the places, he starts at his home base. So yeah. It would be like us going to the local ward and then branching out from there. We meet the people, we talk to them, and of course, you know, hopefully they're on the right track. And if not, we've got to figure out how to get them on the right track. But then we branch out and we go from there.
And I think most cases, one of the really impressive things about the church is that almost anywhere you go, they are on track. And, you know, there are times when you can give yourself a big head thinking, yes, I'm this special person, and then you go there and you think, yeah, they don't need me. They're doing just fine by themselves and probably better without
me. I think in my experience, they do better with the gospel and the beliefs. The programs, not so much, but then again, that's not always what the gospel is about. It's really about the doctrine and the belief in Jesus. And be right back for the last segment of our Come Follow Me discussion, and we'll talk more about witnessing with John Gee and Kevin Christensen right after this message. Good evening, everyone. This is Terry Hutchinson with John Gee and Kevin Christensen for our Come Follow Me presentation for lesson 22, was it, John?
I don't know. They don't number the lessons.
Oh, okay, but it's Acts 22.
No, they don't number the lessons.
Yeah.
I think it's because it's more important what we're doing rather than what number it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's... So they give you the dates when they want it done, and they give you the scriptures that they want you to cover, and then whether you do which number of lessons it is secondary.
You know, but the great thing about it is we're just at the infancy of this process, and it just is fascinating to see. I teach 18-year-olds now. And so you can tell the ones whose families are doing it and the ones whose families don't. And, you know, it used to be when I taught that class, you were there with them every week, and now might get to talk to them once a month or so. It just depends. So it's all about what's going on in the homes.
Yeah, and I'm impressed with these lesson manuals. They are some of the most well thought out and some of the best manuals that I think I have ever seen in the church.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had some good ones. But these are the questions that they ask really bring some of these points home in ways that you might not have thought of. And so they are definitely worth doing. We're talking about standing as witnesses. And for a lot of people, this is a daunting task. And so I want to read a quote from Elder Holland. This is way back in 2001, but I think it's still applicable today. He says, "Above all else, we can live the gospel. Surely there is no more powerful missionary message we can send to this world than the example of a loving and happy Latter-day Saint life. The manner and bearing, the smile and kindness of a faithful member of the church brings a warmth and an outreach which no missionary tract or videotape can convey. And then skipping down the list a little bit, he says, asking every member to be a missionary is not nearly as crucial as asking every member to be a member. Thank you for living the gospel. And I think that's something that we can, that seems approachable to us. I know a lot of extremely shy people who don't like to put themselves forward at all. And yet this is something that is in the reach of just about anybody.
Yeah.
You can live the gospel, and that in itself can be, in some cases, the most eloquent witness that you can give.
When I was in the military, we were in a ward where I was one of the counselors in the Elders Quorum Presidency. That's when elders really were elders in that day instead of what we have today. But myself, I'm an attorney, educated. The other counselor with me was a polygraph examiner for the military. So he had quite a bit of education and training. And our president was a very modest and humble guy who did some medical appliances for people. Very simple, not technical, not training. He was an enlisted person, and he wasn't even a high-ranking enlisted person. And yet he was quiet and shy. He didn't like to talk in front of the group. And so he just said, brothers, I need you to help me do these things that I'm not very good at, and I will just do what I do. And he had a bond with the young single soldiers that was incredible because of his humility and his modest nature. He could relate to them. They didn't feel threatened by him, and he brought many of them to church for the first time in years. And it was just an incredible lesson to me about how the gospel and witnessing can be done by people who really care, and also by people, like you say, and Elder Holland says, who live the gospel.
Yeah, I'm sure you have some experience with that, Kevin.
Well, yeah, my wife has done several tours of duty as Relief Society president, and one of the things that I notice with her is when I go to church with Shauna, and she'll walk around the ward, and these other sisters will look, oh, so Shauna, and they'll embrace and hug, and there's this genuine joy in being together and serving each other and being aware of what's going on in each other's lives. And so that's where the gospel is demonstrated, in just these awareness and kindness and paying attention to each other and being there for each other when... in situations like that. So yeah, that's something it's getting out of the books and into life sometimes is important.
Yeah, to paraphrase Elder Holland again, too often we have the men as the theologians and the women as the Christians, that quiet witness that comes from doing things is sometimes a better and more needed than whatever we might learn from our study.
And that's something I have to work on a lot. I find myself looking at my bookshelf thinking, I socialize too much.
Oh, well, sometimes it's the gifts differing. There's the list of spiritual gifts, and we can do different things. And sometimes, just appreciating the goodness of what people's different gifts are in sharing the gospel in their own way is important. One thing, while we're talking about Paul as a witness, I was thinking about, there's a forthcoming interpreter essay by John where he talks about the importance of standing as a witness of God in all times and all places, not sometimes in some places. And this is, you know, this is something that that's going to come up in people's lives, you know, when we're in the workplace or a church or, you know, as scholars, when, you know, do we want to be, who are, you know, what are we writing for when we do this?
Yeah, well, it's important to be a witness at all times and all things, and not just some of the time, and not just in certain cases. And sometimes we forget, and this is a problem prevalent in academics, is to exempt ourselves and not let our witness show when we're dealing with the subjects where it needs to show the most. For example, writing a book and on Joseph Smith, and I'm thinking of one in particular where they're writing about Joseph Smith, and they would say that Joseph Smith thought he was inspired, and would say that Orson Pratt said Joseph Smith was inspired, but you didn't know where the author stood.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there may be more and less appropriate ways in an academic setting to do that, but you really have to wonder, if you're leaving somebody feeling guessing in your work, whether you're really a believer or not, you wonder, are you really being the witness that you can and
you
should
be?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in the latest book by Tom Alexander, the one Brigham Young and the Expansion of Mormonism, it came out a couple of months ago. I have really enjoyed that book. I appreciate Alexander's work, have for years, but it's not what you call narratively gripping. However, this one is, and part of it, I think, is the format, which is the Oklahoma Western Biography series, which is basically secondary sources, not primary, not heavily footnoted, and it's more of a narrative style, and he tells a story about Brigham here. But at the very beginning, he specifically mentions in the introduction or the preface that he is a believer, and he's a traditional believer, and he comments about how when President Nelson talked about changing the references to the church from Mormon to something else, that it came too late to fix most of this book, but he's tried to do so in certain ways that you can see in the book. And for me, that was a very good example about standing as a witness, as a scholar, or as somebody who does that. There's no question about where he stands, even if the text of his article says, well, maybe this or maybe that, at least he's declared himself at the first. To me, that's the intellectually honest way to do it.
Yeah, there are times when you're constrained by your venue, but your witness sometimes comes out anyway.
Yeah.
It should come out anyway.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody...
You don't have to be obnoxious about it, but we can let the truth of who we are shows up in our writing, and I think that's important.
And it's a talent that you can do or something, because I know Oxford is pretty strict about their desire not to have devotional books, if you call them that, but to have...
Well, I got published by Oxford, and I was devotional in what I wrote, so...
Well, again, I'm going to...
Well, I remember that one.
Elder Holland here.
Yeah.
You don't have to have a prescribed missionary message. Your faith, your happiness, the very look on your faith is enough to quicken the honest in heart.
Yeah.
Haven't you ever heard a grandmother talk about her grandchildren? That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Minus the photographs. The gospel will just tumble out. You won't be able to contain yourself. So if that witness will come out whether... If we believe and we're willing to let that show, it will come out. And if we try to hide it, it'll still come out. And if we're faking it, That's often apparent, much more apparent to our audience than we would tend to believe.
Yeah. And I think it's important to remember, too, and Kevin is in Pennsylvania somewhere, and he has the opportunity all the time to be with people who aren't necessarily believers. And I think we here in Utah and in the you know, whatever the corridor is that they call it, we need to have that same witness, because there's a lot of our people around us who struggle with that. They struggle with living it, or they struggle with their faith, or they don't want to hear about it, or they don't do the things that will help them to weather the storms that are coming up. And so I think it's important for us to always be that witness to everybody around us, no matter where we live.
Right. We don't want to be responsible for the people who were knocked off and loosened from their contacts in church because we had an attitude in different.
Well, thank you, John and Kevin, for being with us. That wraps it up for our Interpreter Radio this evening. And we thank you just
for listening.
That's right. And join us again next week. Same